Time Warner Audiobooks presents Rich Dad's Rich Kid, Smart Kid, giving your children a financial head start. Written by Robert T. Kiyosaki with Sharon L. Lecter, CPA. Read by Jim Ward and featuring commentary by Robert T. Kiyosaki and Sharon L. Lecter.
Hello, this is Robert Kiyosaki. In the industrial age, the rules were go to school, get good grades, find a safe, secure job with benefits, and stay there all your life. After 40 years or so, you retire, and the company and the government takes care of you for the rest of your life. In the information age, the rules have changed. The rules now are go to school, get good grades, find a job, and then retrain yourself for that job. After a while, you find a new company, a new job, and retrain, and repeat the process. Somewhere along the line, you hope and pray that you have enough money set aside to last you much longer than age 65. Other subtle yet significant changes between the ages are, in the industrial age, the employer was responsible for your retirement plan. In the information age, the employee is responsible. If you run out of money after age 65, it is your problem, not the company's problem. In the industrial age, you became more valuable the older you got. In the information age, you become less valuable the older you get. In the industrial age, people are employees for life. In the information age, people are now free agents. In the industrial age, you could count on the government to bail you out if you and your family got in financial trouble. As the information age begins, we hear more and more politicians promising to save Social Security and other government safety net programs. You and I are smart enough to know that when politicians begin to make promises to save something, the chances are what they are promising to save is already gone. When change occurs, there is typically resistance. In the last few years, there are many examples of people recognizing the opportunities that arise during a period of change. Today, we have information age companies started by 20-year-olds buying industrial age corporations run by 45-year-olds. Today, we have 20-year-old self-made billionaires who have never had a job, and at the same time, we have 45-year-olds who are starting over, retraining for a new job. It is said that in the near future, individuals will go online and bid for jobs rather than apply for jobs. It is said that people who want jobs longer than a year, i.e. greater security, will have to accept less money for that security. Instead of hoping to find a good job with a big company, more and more students are starting their own businesses in their dorm rooms. Harvard University even has a special office that assists students in developing their incubator businesses as a way to help them build the businesses, but more to keep them in school. And at the same time, half of the employees of one of America's largest employers earn so little that they qualify for food stamps. What will happen to these employees when they are too old to work? Was their education adequate? Homeschooling is no longer a fringe form of alternative education. Today, the number of kids being educated at home is increasing by 15% per year. More and more parents realize that their child's early education is as important to a child's development as college is, so they are looking for alternatives. Simply put, the information age will bring economic changes that will dramatically increase the gap between the haves and have-nots. For some people, these changes will be a blessing. For others, these coming changes will be a curse. And for still others, nothing will make much of a difference in their lives. As my rich dad said, there are people who make things happen. There are people who watch things happen, and there are people who say, "What happened?" Education is more important than ever before because the world is and will be changing faster than we ever expected. So ask yourself, is the education your children are receiving today adequately preparing them for the future they face? Is the school system catering to the special needs of your child? What do parents do if their child dislikes school or is doing poorly in school? Do good grades ensure lifelong professional and financial success? Does your child even need to go to a traditional brick-and-mortar school in order to receive the education he or she needs? This program is to assist parents in preparing their children for the real world. It is specifically for parents who want to give their child a financial head start in life without costing them a fortune, and who want to ensure their child's natural genius and learning style are protected, and that their child leaves school excited about being a lifelong learner. It was my smart dad, my real father, who often said, "A child's most important teachers are his and her parents." Many parents say to their children, "Go to school and study hard. A good education is important." The problem is many parents who say these words do not continue with their own education or studies. He also said, Children learn by watching more than they do listening. Children are tuned in to watch for discrepancies between words and actions. Children love to catch parents saying one thing and doing something else. My rich dad tended to agree and used to say, "Your actions speak louder than your words." He also said, "If you want to be a good parent, you need to walk your talk."
For those who have read my other books or listened to the tapes, you already know that I had two father figures in my life. One man I called my rich dad, and one man I called my poor dad. The benefit I had was that both men were geniuses in their own right. The man I call my poor dad, in my opinion, was an academic genius and educator. After the age of 9, I began having serious problems in school. I did not like what I was learning and how I was being taught. I saw no relevance between what I was being forced to learn and how I could apply it to the real world. My smart but poor dad continued to guide me through this very difficult part of my life. If not for my smart dad, I would have dropped or flunked out of school and never would have gone on to graduate with my college degree. My other dad, Rich Dad, was a financial genius and also a great teacher. He was also the father of my best friend, Mike. It was Rich Dad who prepared my young mind to think like a rich person. Between the ages of 9 and 12, and because of my Rich Dad's guidance, I was absolutely certain that I would attain great wealth, regardless if I did well in school or got a high-paying job. By the age of 12, I knew that becoming rich had little to do with what I was learning in school. Knowing I was going to be rich, regardless of how I did in school, did create some unique attitude problems for me while I was still in school. But both dads worked to keep my attitude problem in check and guided me to complete my college education. When you look at an overview of the current educational system, it is obvious that the system focuses on two main areas of education. They are scholastic education, the ability to read, to write, and to do arithmetic, and professional education, the education to become a doctor, lawyer, plumber, secretary, or whatever you want to do to earn money once you leave school. America and many Western nations have done an excellent job in making these two fundamental types of education available to their citizens. But in the information age, we need more new education, not more of the same education. Each and every student now needs some of the basic education my rich dad gave me. Financial education. The education required to turn the money you earn from your profession into lifelong wealth and financial security. This program will offer some insights into what that education should include to assist you and your children in the future. My rich dad would say, "My banker has never asked for my report card. All my banker wants to see are my financial statements." The problem is, most people leave school not knowing what a financial statement is. Rich Dad would also say, "Understanding how financial statements work is essential for anyone wanting to build a life of financial security. And in today's world of less and less job security, it is essential that your child have the skills to ensure a life of financial security." When I was a little boy, my rich dad often said, "Money is an idea." He would go on to say, "Money can be anything you want it to be. If you say, 'I'll never be rich,' then the chances are you'll never be rich. If you say, 'I can't afford it,' then chances are you can't." My smart dad said much the same about education. Is it possible that every child is born with the potential to be rich and smart? This program is about fostering and preserving that possibility. Both my dads were great teachers. Both men were smart men. But they were not smart in the same subjects, and they did not teach the same things. Yet as different as they were, both dads believed the same things about all kids. Both dads believed all kids are born smart and all kids are born rich. They both believed a child learns to be poor and learns to believe that he or she is less smart than other kids. Both dads were great teachers because they believed in bringing out the genius that each child is born with. In other words, they did not believe in putting knowledge in. They believed in bringing the child's genius out. Both my dads were great teachers because they rarely tried to cram their ideas into my head. They often said very little, waiting instead for me to ask when I wanted to know something. Or they asked me questions, seeking to find out what I knew, rather than simply telling me what they knew. And not to forget the moms. My mom was a great teacher and role model also. She was my teacher for unconditional love, kindness, and the importance of caring for other people. I once heard that boys marry women just like their moms, and I would say that is true for me. My wife Kim is also an extremely kind and loving person. I did not know my best friend Mike's mom very well. Yet the times I was over at their home, Mike's mother was also very kind and attentive to what we were doing. Although a very private person, she was always interested in what Mike and I were learning at school and in the business. I could tell she was a great life partner for Mike's dad. Although I did not know her very well, I learned from her the importance of listening to others, letting others talk, and being respectful of the ideas of others, even if they clash with your ideas. She was a great communicator in a very quiet way. Lessons from my mom and dad. The number of single-parent families I see today concerns me. Having both a mom and a dad as teachers was important in my development. My dad would often say, "True intelligence is knowing what is appropriate rather than what is simply right or wrong." As a 6-year-old boy, I learned from my mom that I needed to be kind and gentle. But when I found myself constantly confronted by bullies at school, I also learned that I could at times be too kind and gentle. I hated being called fatty and dumbo. Consequently, after talking with my dad, I learned to be strong and to stand up for myself. But there had to be balance. My father told me that many people live in a black-and-white world, or a right-and-wrong world. Many say, don't push back, and some say, push back. The key to being successful in life is, if you must push back, you need to know exactly how hard to push. When I got pushed or put down, I learned exactly how hard to push back. Knowing exactly how hard to push requires much more intelligence than simply saying, don't push back, or push back. My dad would often say, true intelligence is knowing what is appropriate rather than what is right or wrong. I think today we need to be more intelligent with our strengths and our weaknesses. It used to be when I was a kid and I got angry with another guy at school, we would begin to wrestle, get tired, and then the fight would be over. The worst that happened was an occasional torn shirt or bloody nose. Today, kids get angry, start thinking in the less intelligent right and wrong mode, break out their guns and shoot each other. We may be in the information age, and kids may be more worldly than their parents, but we can all learn to be more intelligent with our information and our emotions. We need to learn from both our mothers and fathers. Because of so much more information, we need to be that much more intelligent. Is your child a genius? If there is one thing I've noticed, it is that all parents are astounded by how fast their children learn. Every new parent I've met is sure that their child is the smartest kid in the world, and maybe even a genius. And I tend to agree with them. I think all children are born geniuses. But for many children, something happens to that genius along the way, as they grow up. For some children, that genius seems to disappear, gets pushed down, or goes in other directions. Although my wife Kim and I do not have children, newborn babies always fascinate me. I love looking in their eyes. When I look into their eyes, I see a most curious and inquisitive being staring back. It is easy to see that the child is learning in quantum leaps. Everything they can soak in with their eyes is new, is a wonderment, and is being added to their data bank unedited, qualified, or without much prejudice. They are soaking in this new experience called life. The job of parents is to foster and maintain that curiosity and love of learning. The belief that all kids are born geniuses was one of my real dad's core beliefs. My real dad was an academic genius. He was a voracious reader, a great writer, a brilliant speaker, and a great teacher. He was a top student all through school, often having all A's, and served as a class officer. He graduated from the University of Hawaii way ahead of the rest of his class, and went on to become one of the youngest school principals in Hawaii's history. He was invited to do graduate work at Stanford University, the University of Chicago, and Northwestern University. In the late 1980s, he was selected by his peers as one of the two top educators in Hawaii's 50-year history of public education and awarded an honorary doctorate's degree. Even though I call him my poor dad because he was always broke, regardless of how much money he made, I was very proud of him. He often said, "I'm not interested in money." And he also said, "I'll never be rich." And those words became self-fulfilling prophecies. But many of the ideas in this program about how children learn and why all children are born smart come from my real dad. The following story is about a classmate of mine who was labeled early in life a genius. It is also about how we are all geniuses in one way or another. Does your child have a high financial IQ? When you say someone has a high IQ, what does that mean? What does your IQ measure? Does having a high IQ guarantee that you will be successful? Does having a high IQ mean you will be rich? When I was in the fourth grade, my teacher announced to the class, "Students, we are honored to have a genius in our midst. He is a very gifted child, and he has a very high IQ." She then went on to announce that one of my best friends, Andrew, was one of the brightest students she had ever had the privilege to teach. Up until that time, Andy the Ant, as we all called Andrew, was just one of the kids in the class. We called him Andy the Ant because he was tiny and had thick glasses that made him look like a bug. Now we had to call him Andy the Brainy Ant. Not understanding what IQ meant, I raised my hand and asked the teacher, "What does IQ mean?" The teacher sputtered a little and replied, "IQ means intelligence quotient. Now get the dictionary and look it up." "Okay," I said with a grin. After reading the definition, I looked up and said, "I still don't understand what IQ means." At that point, Andy the Ant stood up from behind his wooden desk and walked to the chalkboard at the front of the room. He then wrote on the board equations, which essentially showed that if he divided his mental age, which was 18, by his chronological age, which was 10, and multiplied by 100, then he had an IQ of 180. People say I am a genius because I'm 10 years of age, but have the test scores of a person who is 18 years of age. The class sat silently for a while to digest the information that Andy had just put on the board. In other words, if you don't increase your abilities to learn as you get older, then your IQ could come down, I said. "That's how I would interpret it," said Andy. "I might be a genius today, but if I don't increase what I know, my IQ comes down with each year. At least that's what the equation represents." "So you could be a genius today, but be a dummy tomorrow," I said with a laugh. "Very funny," said Andy, "but accurate." While this story highlights standard intelligence testing, how do you measure people's financial IQ? Do you measure it by how big their paycheck is, by their net worth, the kind of car they drive, or by the size of their house? Several years later, long after the discussion about Andy the Ant being a genius, I asked my rich dad what he thought financial IQ meant. He quickly replied, "Financial intelligence is not about how much money you make, but how much money you keep, and how hard that money works for you." Yet as time went on, he refined his definition of financial intelligence. He once said, "You know your financial intelligence is increasing if, as you get older, your money is buying you more freedom, happiness, health, and choices in life." He went on to explain that many people made more money as they got older, but their money only bought them less freedom. Less freedom in the form of having bigger bills to pay. Having bigger bills meant the person had to work harder to pay them. To Rich Dad, this was not financially intelligent. He also explained that he saw many people making a lot of money, but their money did not make them happier. To him, that was not financially intelligent. "Why work for money and be unhappy?" he said. "If you must work for money, find a way to work and be happy. That is financial intelligence." When it came to health, he would say, "Too many people work too hard for money and slowly kill themselves in the process. Why work hard, sacrificing the mental and physical well-being of your family as well as yourself? That is not financially intelligent. Too many people think about working harder rather than thinking about how to have more fun and enjoy this great gift of life." My rich dad went on to explain that financial intelligence gave a person more choices in life by saying, "Money is power because more money gives you more choices." And when it came to choices, he would say, "I know the first class section of an airplane arrives at the same time as the economy section. That is not the issue. The issue is, do you have the choice of flying first class or flying economy? Most people in the economy section have no choice." My rich dad did not measure his financial IQ in traditional financial measurements. He was never really fixated on how much money he had, or his net worth, or the size of his portfolio. If I were to define what financial intelligence bought him, it would be freedom. He cherished the free time that money bought him. He loved having the time to watch his children grow up and work on projects that interested him, whether or not they made money. My rich dad measured his financial IQ in time more than money. The later years of his life were the most joyous because he spent most of his time giving his money away, rather than trying to conserve and hang on to it. He seemed to have as much fun giving it away as a philanthropist as he did making it as a capitalist. He lived a rich, happy, and generous life. Most importantly, he had a life of boundless freedom, and that is how he measured his financial IQ. One of your responsibilities as a parent is to teach your kids about the financial world, so that they will constantly be ahead of the curve when it comes to financial IQ. What is intelligence? When our teacher announced to the class that Andy the Ant was a genius with a high IQ, in essence, she also told us that the rest of us were not. I went home and asked my dad what his definition of intelligence was. His reply was simple. All he said was, "Intelligence is the ability to make finer distinctions." I stood there for a moment, not understanding what he had said. Finally, he realized that I did not understand his explanation, so he began to speak in the language of a 10-year-old. "Do you know what the word sports means?" my dad asked. "Sure I do," I said. "I love sports." "Good," he replied. "Is there a difference between football, golf, and surfing?" "Of course there is," I said excitedly. "There are huge differences between those sports." "Good," my father continued in his teacher mode. "Those differences are called distinctions." "You mean distinctions are the same as differences?" I asked. My dad nodded his head. "So the more I can tell the differences between something, then the more intelligent I am?" I asked. "That is correct," my dad answered. "So you have a much higher sports IQ than Andy, but Andy has a much higher academic IQ than you. What this really means is that Andy learns best by reading, and you learn best by doing. So Andy has an easier time learning in the classroom, and you have an easier time learning on the athletic field. Andy will learn history and science quickly, and you will learn baseball and football quickly. So I learn by playing games, and Andy learns by reading." My dad nodded his head, and then he said, "Our school system puts great importance upon academic or scholastic intelligence. So when they say someone has a high IQ, they mean a high scholastic or academic IQ. The current IQ test measures primarily a person's verbal IQ, or his or her ability to read and write. So technically, a person with a high IQ is someone who learns quickly by reading. It does not measure all of a person's intelligence. So IQ is not a measure of a person's artistic IQ, physical IQ, or even their mathematical intelligence, which are all legitimate intelligences." As I began to understand, I said, "So when my teacher says that Andy is a genius, it means that he is better at learning by reading than I am, and I am better at learning by doing." My dad nodded his head. "You still need to learn to read, but it seems that you will learn faster by doing than reading. In many ways, Andy has a problem, in that he can read but cannot do. In some ways, he may find the real world a harder place to adapt to than you will. He will do well as long as he remains in the world of academics or science. And that is why he has a hard time on the baseball field, or in talking to the rest of the kids. This is why I think it's great that you and your friends allow him to be on your sports teams. You are teaching him things that a school book could never teach him. Subjects and skills that are very important for success in the real world." "Andy is a great friend," I said, "but he would rather read than play baseball. And I would rather play baseball than read. So it means he is smarter in the classroom because he learns better there. But that does not mean he is smarter than me. His high IQ means he is a genius at learning by reading. So I need to find a way to make more distinctions faster so that I can learn faster, in a way that works best for me." My educator dad smiled. "That's the attitude. Find a way to make distinctions quickly and you will learn quickly. Always remember that nature multiplies by dividing," he said. "Just as a cell increases by splitting, the same is true with intelligence. The moment we split a subject into two, we have increased our intelligence. If we then split the two into two, we get four, and our intelligence is now multiplying. Multiplying by dividing. That is called quantum learning, not linear learning." I nodded my head, understanding how learning could get faster once I first figured out how I learned best. "When I first started playing baseball, I didn't know much," I said. "But I soon found out the difference between striking out, a home run, and an RBI. Is that what you mean when you say that my intelligence increases by dividing or making finer distinctions?" "That is correct," my dad replied. "And the more you play the game, the more you will keep discovering new and finer distinctions. Don't you find yourself improving as you learn more?" "Yeah," I said. "When I first started playing baseball, I couldn't even hit the ball. Now I can bunt, drag hit, hit line drives, or go for the fence with a home run. You know that I've hit 3 home runs this year?" I said proudly with a grin. "Yes, I know," my dad said, "and I'm very proud of you." "So my baseball IQ is really high," I said with a smile. "Very high," said my dad, "just as Andy's academic IQ is really high, but he can't hit a baseball." "You're telling me," I said. "Andy may know the difference between a bunt and a home run, but he couldn't do either one of them if his life depended on it." And that is the problem with judging a person only on their academic IQ, my educator dad said. Often people with high academic IQs do not do well in the real world. Why is that? I asked. That is a good question that I really have no answer for. I think it is because educators focus primarily on mental skills and not on converting mental knowledge into physical knowledge. I also think that we educators punish people for making mistakes, and if you're afraid of making mistakes, you will not want to do anything. It is the fear of making a mistake and then looking foolish that prevents people from taking action. And ultimately, we all learn via taking action. We all know we learn by making mistakes, yet in our school system, we punish people for making too many of them. So having a high IQ may only mean Andy learns faster by reading, but it doesn't mean I can't learn as much as he knows, I replied, seeking greater clarity. I can learn something if I want to learn it. Isn't that true? That's it, said my dad. Education is attitude. And if you have that kind of positive attitude towards learning, you will do well. But if you have a loser's attitude, or a defeated attitude towards learning, then you will never learn anything. That day I learned that I learn best by doing first, and then by reading about it. For example, with baseball, the more I played the game, the more I wanted to read about it. But if I did not play the game, I had no interest in reading about it. It was a way of learning that worked best for me. It was a way I would learn for the rest of my life. If I tried something first and then found it interesting, I would be more excited about reading about it. But if I could not physically be involved first, or had only to read about something, I was rarely interested, and hence did not want to read about it. That one explanation from my educator dad was the primary reason I finished high school and went on to survive a very tough federal military academy with a rigorous academic curriculum. I knew that although I did not have a high academic IQ, it did not mean that I was not smart. It merely meant I had to find a way of learning that worked best for me. How many different geniuses are there? In the early 1980s, Howard Gardner wrote the book Frames of Mind, in which he identified 7 different geniuses or intelligences. They are 1. Verbal linguistic. This is the genius that our educational system currently measures a person's IQ from. It is a person's native ability to read and write words. It is a very important intelligence, because this genius is one of the primary ways humans gather information and share information. Journalists, writers, attorneys, and teachers are often blessed with this genius. 2. Numerical. This is the genius that deals with data measured in numbers. Obviously, a mathematician would be blessed with this genius. A formally trained engineer would need to be good at both verbal linguistic and numerical genius. 3. Spatial. This is the genius many creative people have. They are often great artists or designers. An architect would have to be good at all 3 of these first geniuses, because the profession would require words, numbers, and creative design. 4. Physical. This is the genius that many great athletes and dancers are blessed with. There are also many people who do not do well in school who are gifted physically. These are often people who learn by doing, or what is often called hands-on learning. Many times, people with this genius gravitate towards mechanics or the building trades. In other words, they are geniuses by seeing, touching, and doing things. A person who designs racing cars would need to have all 4 geniuses. 5. Intrapersonal. This is the genius often called emotional intelligence. In other words, it's what we say to ourselves, for example, when we are fearful or angry. One of the main reasons people are often unsuccessful is not due to lack of mental knowledge. The reason is often found emotionally. For example, I know many smart people with good grades who are less successful than they could be simply because they live in terror of making a mistake or failing. Many times, people do not make money simply because they fear losing money more than they could enjoy making money. In his book, Emotional Intelligence, Daniel Goleman quotes the 16th century humanist Erasmus of Rotterdam, who states that emotional thinking can be 24 times more powerful than rational thinking. I agree that intrapersonal intelligence is the most important of all geniuses. I say that because intrapersonal genius is our control over what we say to ourselves. It's me talking to myself and you talking to yourself. 6. Interpersonal is the genius found when you talk to other people. People with this genius are often great communicators, charismatic people, great singers, preachers, politicians, actors, salespeople, speakers, etc. 7. Environmental. This genius is the genius that relates to humans and the things around them. There are people who are naturally gifted in dealing with such things as trees, plants, fish, the ocean, animals, and the land. This is the genius that great farmers, animal trainers, oceanographers, and park rangers possess. Since the distinction of these different geniuses was discovered, there have been over 30 other geniuses identified. So our intelligence about the subject of genius continues to increase because we keep making future distinctions. People who do not do well in school, even if they try very hard, often do not have a strong verbal linguistic genius. These people do not learn by sitting still, listening to lectures, or by reading. They learn or are gifted in other areas. My real dad was definitely verbal linguistically gifted, which is why he read well, wrote well, and had a high IQ. He was also a great communicator, which meant he was also strong in interpersonal genius. My rich dad, on the other hand, was gifted in the genius that is second on the list, the mathematical genius. He was a very good speaker, and his interpersonal skills were excellent. He had hundreds of employees who loved working for him. He also was not afraid of taking risks, which meant his intrapersonal genius was very strong. In other words, he had strong attention to numerical detail, combined with the ability to take investment risks, as well as build companies that people love to work for. Find your genius and become a genius. My dad, the head of education, knew that I would not do well in school. He knew that sitting in a room, listening to lectures, reading books, and studying subjects without any physical mass to them was not my best way of learning. In fact, he often said, "I doubt any of my kids will do well in school." My dad was smart enough to encourage his kids to find their own genius and their own ways of learning. He knew that each of his kids was different, had different geniuses, and learned differently, although we were all from the same parents. When he found out I was really interested in money and capitalism, subjects he had no interest in, he encouraged me to seek teachers who could teach me those subjects. That is why, at the age of 9, I began to learn from my rich dad. Although my real dad respected my rich dad, they did not see eye to eye on many subjects. My dad, being a great educator, knew that if a child was interested in a subject, the child had a better chance of discovering his or her native geniuses. He allowed me to study subjects of my interest, even though he did not particularly like the subject. And when I did not have good grades in school, he did not become upset, even though he was the head of the educational system. He knew that even though school was important, it was not the place where I would discover my genius. He knew if children studied what they were interested in, they would find their geniuses and succeed. He knew his kids were smart. He told us we were smart, even though we often had poor grades in school. Being a great teacher, he knew that the true definition of education was to draw out your genius, not just to cram information in. My dad was adamant about protecting the genius of all children. He would say, "A parent's most important job is to keep their children's geniuses and their love of learning alive, especially if the children do not like school. If he had not done that for me, I would have left school long before graduating. He kept my love of learning alive by encouraging me to develop my geniuses, even though I was not an academic genius in school." One of the things you can do is give your children the encouragement and the opportunity to find out what kind of geniuses they really are, or the kind of geniuses they will eventually become. Give your children power before you give them money. One of the most common questions I am asked when I go on speaking engagements is, "Doesn't it take money to make money?" My answer is, no, it does not. I then go on to say, "Money comes from your ideas, simply because money is just an idea." Another question I am asked is, "How do I invest if I don't have any money to invest? How can I invest when I can't even afford to pay my bills?" My reply is, "The first thing I would recommend is to stop saying, 'I can't afford it.'" I know that for many people, my answers are unsatisfactory, since many times people are looking for immediate answers on how to get a few dollars quickly so they can invest and get ahead in life. I want people to know that they have the power and the ability to have all the money they want, if they want it. And that power is not found in money. The power is not found outside of them. The power is found in their ideas. It has nothing to do with money. It has to do with power, the power of their ideas. The good news is that it doesn't take money. All it takes is the willingness to change a few ideas, and you can gain power over money, rather than allow money to have power over you. My rich dad often said, "Poor people are poor, simply because they have poor ideas." He also said, most poor people learn their ideas about money and life from their parents. Since we teach nothing about money in school, the ideas of money are handed down from parent to child for generations. For me, I learned very early that I didn't want to be poor. So I studied with my rich dad. And one of his first lessons was, the rich don't work for money. Instead, my rich dad taught me to have money work for me, through investments and building businesses. In my first book and audio program, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, the story of my rich dad taking my 10 cents an hour away from me drew quite a reaction from our readers and listeners. In other words, he had me work for him for free. But when my rich dad took my 10 cents an hour away, he was taking the money away so I could find my power over money. He wanted me to know that I could make money without money. He wanted me to find the power to create money rather than learn to work for money. Rich Dad said, if you do not need money, you will make a lot of money. People who need money never really become rich. It is that neediness that robs you of your power. You must work hard and learn to never need money. Although he gave his other kids an allowance, he did not give his son Mike an allowance, and he did not pay us for working for him. He said, by giving children an allowance, you teach them to work for money rather than learn to create money. Now, I am not saying that you should have your kids work for free, and I am not saying not to give your child an allowance. I would not be foolish enough to tell you what to tell your own child, since every child is different and every situation is different. What I am saying is that money comes from ideas, and if you truly want to give your child a financial head start in life, I would be very vigilant over your ideas and your child's ideas. There is an overused saying that goes, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. A more accurate saying would be, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with the idea to make the journey. And when it comes to money, many people start their life's journey with poor ideas or ideas that limit them later in life. So when do you teach a child about money? My answer is, when your child becomes interested in money. My rich dad took the 10 cents an hour away because I asked him to teach me to be rich. He did not do it just to teach me something about money. I asked to learn to be rich. I did not just want to learn about money, and there is a difference. If the child does not necessarily want to learn to be rich, then obviously the lesson should be different. One of the reasons Rich Dad gave his other children an allowance was because his children were not interested in getting rich. So he taught them different lessons about money. Although the lessons were different, he still taught them to have power over money rather than to spend a life in need of money. As Rich Dad said, the more you need money, the less power you have. The ages between 9 and 15. Different educational psychologists have told me that the ages between 9 and 15 are crucial ages in a child's development. I am also not an expert in child development, so take what I say as general guidelines rather than the words of professional experience. One expert I talked to said that approximately the age of 9, children begin to break away from their parents' identity and seek their own identity. I know that it was true for me, because at the age of 9, I began to work with my rich dad. I wanted to break away from my parents' reality of the world, so I needed a new identity. Another expert has said that between these ages, children develop what they call their winning formula. This expert described the winning formula as the child's idea on how he or she will best survive and win. I knew by age 9 that school was not a part of my winning formula, especially after my friend Andy was labeled a genius and I wasn't. I thought that I had a better chance of being a sports star or being rich than an academic person. In other words, if a child thinks that he or she is good in school, his or her winning formula may be to stay in school and graduate with honors. If the child is not doing well in school or does not like school, the child may seek a different formula. This expert also said that conflicts between parent and child begin when the child's winning formula for success is not the same as the parent's. The family problems begin when the parents begin to impose their winning formula on the child without first respecting the child's formula. A parent needs to listen closely for the child's winning formula. But before continuing with giving your child power over money, there is something worth mentioning for adults. Many adults get into trouble later in life when they realize that the winning formulas they came up with as kids are no longer winning for them. Many adults then seek job or career changes. Some continue to try and make the formula work even after they realize it is not working. And still others go into depression, thinking they have failed in life, when all it is a winning formula that stopped winning. In other words, people are generally happy if they are happy with their winning formula. People become unhappy with life if they are tired of their formulas, or the formulas are no longer winning, or they realize that their formulas are not getting them to where they want to go. Finding the power to create a winning formula that wins. One of the most important things parents can do is to help their children create winning formulas that win. And it is very important that a parent be aware of how to do this without interfering with the child's own development. The most important thing parents can do when it comes to money is to give their children the perception that they have power over money, rather than being slaves to money. You don't have to be born poor to become poor. Many poor people are poor because they learn to be poor at home. People can also develop a poor perception of themselves, even though they come from rich and middle-class families. Something happens to them along the road of life, and they pick up the perception that they will always be poor. I believe that is what happened to my dad. When I went bust and lost my first company, the hardest thing I had to do was preserve my perception of myself. If not for my rich dad's lessons on self-perception, I do not know if I would have recovered and gotten stronger from the experience. I have friends today who have gone bust, and although they have recovered financially, what they were left with from the experience was a weakened self-perception. That is why I begin my lessons for parents with the importance of being aware of and protecting the self-perceptions of their children. A strong self-perception can carry them through the ups and downs of life, financially, academically, in relationships, professionally, and other challenges that their lives will encounter. As my rich dad said, the more you need money, the less power you have. There are many people who did well in school and landed that high-paying job, but because they were not taught how to have money work for them, they worked hard for money and got into long-term debt. The more they need money and the longer they need it, very often their self-perception grows weaker as well. Money does not make you rich. Many people collect money in hopes of becoming rich, while others collect college degrees and good grades, hoping to become smart. My personal battle was to overcome my poor financial perception and the perception that I was not as smart as other kids. Perceptions I did not really have until I began to compare myself with other kids. In other words, I did not know I was poor until I met kids who came from families with money. And I did not know I was not too smart until I was compared against kids who had better grades. And hence the title, Rich Kid, Smart Kid. It is my sincere belief that all kids are born with the potential to be rich and smart, as long as that perception of themselves is reinforced and protected from the tons of education they will receive in school, church, business, the media, and from the world itself. Life is tough enough, but it can be even tougher if your self-perception is that you're not smart and that you'll never be rich. The most important role a parent can have is to mold, nurture, and protect the children's perception of themselves. Never say, I can't afford it. My rich dad was not a trained therapist, yet he was smart enough to know that money was just an idea. The reason he forbade his son and me from saying, I can't afford it, was he was using our words to change our perceptions of ourselves. That is why he had to say instead, how can I afford it? I realized that by constantly saying, I can't afford it, I was reinforcing the perception of myself as a poor person. By saying, how can I afford it, I was reinforcing the perception of myself as a rich person. I recommend not saying around your child, I can't afford it. And when your child asks you for money, you may want to say, write me a list of 10 different things that you can do, legally and morally, so you can afford what you want without asking me for the money. If you examine these two statements, you will see that how can I afford it opens your mind to examining the possibilities of accumulating wealth. I can't afford it, on the other hand, closes your mind to any possibility of attaining what you desire. Rich and smart are only perceptions. Your perceptions of your children can greatly affect the outcome of their lives. In other words, if you can see the genius in your child, you will help your child become smarter. If you see your child as rich, you will help your child become richer. And if you teach your children to have those same perceptions of themselves, they will have a better chance of having the rest of the world see the same self-perceptions and treat them accordingly. And to me, this is where your child's education begins. And that is why I say, give your children power before you give them money. help them develop a strong self-perception, and you help them become rich kids and smart kids. If they don't have that, then all the education or money in the world will not help them. If they have that, then getting smarter and richer will only get easier. If you want to be rich, you must do your homework. After a strong and healthy self-perception, one of the most important building blocks to wealth was about homework. In my previous books and audio programs, I explained how I learned about money working for my rich dad from the age of 9 into my college years. In exchange for my labor, he would spend hours teaching his son and me the ins and outs of running a business, as well as the skills needed to be an investor. There was many a Saturday that I rather would have been surfing with my friends or playing some other sport, yet I found myself sitting in my rich dad's office, learning from a man who would one day become one of the wealthiest private citizens in Hawaii. During one of the Saturday lessons, my rich dad asked Mike and me, "Do you know why I will always be richer than the people who work for me?" Mike and I sat, searching our minds for an answer. Finally, I ventured, "Because you make more money than they do?" "Yeah," Mike nodded. "After all, you own the company and you decide how much you get paid and how much they get paid." Rich Dad rocked back in his chair, grinning. "Well, it is true that I decide how much everyone gets paid, but the truth is, I get paid less than many of the employees who work for me." Mike and I both looked at his dad with a suspicious gaze. "If you own this business, how can other people be paid more than you?" Mike asked. "Well, there are several reasons why," replied Rich Dad. "When starting up a business, cash is often tight, and the owner is usually the last to be paid." "You mean the employees always get paid first?" asked Mike. Rich Dad nodded his head, saying, "That is correct. And not only do they get paid first, they often get paid more than I do when I do get paid." "But why is that?" I asked. "Why own a business if you get paid last and get paid the least?" "Because that is what a business owner often needs to do at first if he plans to build a successful business." "That makes no sense," I replied. "Tell me why you do it then." "Because employees work for money, and I work to build an asset," said Rich Dad. "So as you build this business, your pay will go up?" Mike asked. "It may, and it may not. I say this because I want you to know the difference between money and an asset," Rich Dad continued. "I may or I may not pay myself more later on, and I am not working hard for the paycheck. The reason I work hard is to build an asset that increases in value. I may someday sell this business for millions of dollars, or I may hire a president to run it for me one day, and I will go on to build another business." "So, to you, building a business is building an asset, and the asset is more important to you than money," I said. "That's right," said Rich Dad. "And the second reason I get paid less is because I already have other sources of income." "You mean you have money from other assets?" I asked. Rich Dad nodded his head. "And that is the reason I asked you boys the question in the first place. That is why I asked you why I will always be richer than my employees, regardless of who makes the most money and salary. I'm doing my best to teach you a very important lesson. The lesson is, you don't get rich at work. You get rich at home," said Rich Dad strongly, making sure we did not take his words lightly. "What do you mean you get rich at home?" "Well, it's at work where you earn your money. And it is at home where you decide what you're going to do with your money. And it is what you do with your money after you earn it that makes you rich or poor," replied Rich Dad. "It's like homework," said Mike. "Exactly," said Rich Dad. "That is exactly what I call it. I call getting rich my homework." "But my dad brings a lot of work home," I said almost defensively. "But we're not rich." "Well, your dad brings his work home, but he really does not do his homework," said Rich Dad. "Just as your mom does housework. That is not what I mean by homework." "Or yard work," I added. Rich Dad nodded. "Yes, there is a difference between yard work, the school work you bring home, and office work your dad brings home, and the kind of homework I am talking about." It was then my rich dad said something to me I have never forgotten. "The primary difference between the rich, the poor, and the middle class is what they do in their spare time." "Their spare time?" I said in a questioning tone. "What do you mean by their spare time?" Rich Dad smiled at his son and me for a moment. "Where do you think this restaurant business was started?" he asked. "Do you think that this business came out of thin air?" "No," said Mike. "You and Mom started this business at our kitchen table. That is where all your businesses have been started." "That's correct," said Rich Dad. "Do you remember the first small store we started with years ago?" Mike nodded his head. "Those were very tough days for the family. We had so little money." "And how many stores do we have now?" asked Rich Dad. We own 5, Mike replied. And how many restaurants? Asked Rich Dad.
We own 7, said Mike.
As I sat there listening, I began to understand a few new distinctions. So the reason you earn less from this restaurant is because you have income from many other businesses. That is partly the answer, Rich Dad said with a grin. The rest of the answer is found on this Monopoly game board. Understanding the game of Monopoly is the best kind of homework you can do. Let me show you, said Rich Dad as he opened up the game. What happens when you go around Go, he asked.
You collect $200, I replied.
So every time you go around Go, that is like you collecting your paycheck. Is that correct?
Yeah, I guess so, said Mike.
And to win the game, what are you supposed to do? Asked Rich Dad.
You're supposed to buy real estate, I said.
That's right, said Rich Dad. And buying real estate is your homework. That is what makes you rich, not your paycheck.
So are you saying a big paycheck does not make you rich? I asked.
That's correct, said Rich Dad. A paycheck does not make you rich. It is what you do with that paycheck that makes a person rich, poor, or middle class.
I don't understand, I said.
My dad is always saying that if he got a bigger pay raise, we would be rich.
And that is what most people think, said Rich Dad.
But the reality is, the more money most people make, the further in debt they get, so they have to work harder.
And why is that? I asked.
It's because of what they do at home. It's what they do in their spare time, said Rich Dad. Most people have a poor plan or a poor formula for their money after they make it.
So where does a person find a good formula for wealth? Mike asked.
Well, one of the better formulas for wealth is found right here on the Monopoly board, Rich Dad said, pointing to the game board.
What formula? I asked.
Well, how do you win the game? Asked Rich Dad.
You buy several pieces of real estate, then you begin putting houses on them, Mike answered.
How many houses? Asked Rich Dad.
4, I said. 4 green houses.
Good, said Rich Dad. And after you have those 4 green houses, then what do?
You turn those 4 green houses in and buy a red hotel, I said.
And that is one of the formulas for great wealth, said Rich Dad.
For years I have taken the money I have earned in my business and simply bought real estate. Then what I do is live off the income from my real estate and continue to build my businesses. The more money I make from my business, the more money I invest in real estate. That is the formula of great wealth for many people.
Does it have to be real estate? I asked.
No, said Rich Dad. Many people like stocks and bonds.
Do you have stocks and bonds? I asked.
Of course, said Rich Dad.
But I still have more real estate.
But we're getting off the point, said Rich Dad.
And what is the point? I asked.
The point is, you get rich at home, not at work, said Rich Dad. I really want you to understand that. I don't care if you buy real estate or stocks or bonds or build a business. I do care that you understand that most people do not get rich at work. You get rich at home by doing your homework.
The winning formula. One of the most important things I learned from Monopoly was my winning formula. I knew that all I had to do was buy 4 green houses and convert them into a red hotel. I did not know specifically how I was going to do it, but I knew I could do it. At least that was my perception of myself at the time. When I look at the falling test scores of kids today, I believe the same lack of reason or motivation that affected me is having the same effect on kids today. Kids aren't stupid. In fact, kids know far more about real life than many adults. One of the reasons the school system is having a difficult time teaching them is because no one has given them an exciting reason to study hard and stay in school. So the good news was that by playing Monopoly, I found my winning formula. I could see my future at the end of the game. Once I knew I could make it, I wanted to become a millionaire. To me, that was exciting, and I was willing to study to achieve that. But more than becoming rich, I could see that my future would be financially secure and financially free at the end of the game. I did not have the self-perception that I needed a secure job or a company or the government to take care of me. At the age of 15, I knew I was going to be rich. I did not just think it. I knew it. When I knew that, my self-perception soared. The bad news was that I grew more restless. If not for my schoolteacher dad and my rich dad encouraging me to stay in school and get my college degree, I might have left school early. They helped me find out how I learned best, rather than forcing me to study in the way that the school system wanted me to learn. How many winning formulas will your child need? In looking back at the lives of my rich dad and my poor dad, I have come to realize that one was more successful than the other simply because one had more winning formulas.
There are three primary winning formulas a child needs to learn for professional and financial success later in life. The three are a winning learning formula, a winning professional formula, a winning financial formula. Developing a winning learning formula. The years from birth to approximately age 15 are very important years because these are the years a child develops his or her own winning formula for learning. If a child is happy in school, learns easily, and has good grades, the child should develop a viable winning formula for learning. But if children have difficulty learning the three R's in school because they are not strong in the verbal linguistic genius or for other reasons, their years in school can be painful from then on. If a child has a difficult time in school during these early ages, or is made to feel not as smart as the other kids, the child may emotionally begin to develop a lowered self-esteem and a poor attitude towards school in general. Kids may learn to feel stupid and feel that they cannot survive inside the educational system. The children begin to get labeled with distinctions describing their handicaps, terms such as ADD or slow, instead of gifted or bright or genius. So, if your children are doing well in school or not, be observant and encourage your children to find their own unique learning formulas. Because once they leave school and enter the real world, that is where their education really begins. Developing a winning professional formula. Because the world and rules of employment have changed, and for many people in the information age, the older you get, the less valuable you become. A child's winning learning formula needs to be in place just to keep up with the changes in his or her winning professional formulas. In other words, chances are your child will be obsolete by 30 and need to learn a new professional formula just to keep up with professional changes demanded by the marketplace. To say it another way, if your child has the old idea of one profession for life and is not prepared to learn and change quickly, chances are your child will fall further behind with each passing year. The future does not belong to the child who leaves school with the best grades. It belongs to the child with the best winning formula for learning and the freshest technical ideas. More important than learning how to take tests for good grades, a child needs to learn how to learn how to change, and learn how to adapt faster than his or her classmates. Why? Because many of the skills employers and businesses will pay big money for in the future are not taught in school today. Just look at today's business climate. The people most in demand are people who understand the web, a subject not taught in school only a few years ago. At what age are you too old? Today, how old you are may play a role in your success and advancement in your profession. Many careers have a limited time frame for success. An Olympic diver may have a career that spans from age 17 to age 30, while a lawyer may see success up to age 35 or 40. The length of successful career can be determined by many factors, including physical stamina or injuries, as in the case of an athlete or even a lawyer who might be burned out by exhaustion, mental acuity, as in the case of a computer programmer whose skills fall behind, or cultural connection, as in the case of a screenwriter whose ideas aren't quite on the mark anymore. When individuals reach this point in their careers, they often stumble. Today's truth is that if you haven't made it by age 40, you never will. And in some industries, you'll know by age 20 or 25 whether you need to start thinking of a fresh start. And what happens to older workers? The best of the older workers tend to be pushed onwards and upwards into management. The rest tend to be pushed out. My real father hit a stumbling block in his career at age 50. Here he was, a man with a good education, honest, hardworking, and dedicated to improving the education system of the state of Hawaii. But at age 50, he was left out in the cold and without a job and no real survival skills for life outside the walls of education. Although he was a great student in school with a great learning formula, his winning learning formula was not able to re-educate him to survive when his professional formula failed. In the face of such stumbling blocks in your own life, it might be time to change an old winning professional formula. And to do that, you need to change your old winning learning formula. Today, it is important to let your children know that change is part of their future. In fact, it might be important to let your children know that their ability to change and learn quickly is probably more important than what they are learning in school today. Ideas for parents. Parents today need to be smarter because their kids are smarter. Parents need to look beyond school and beyond job security because their kids can see that far ahead. They can see what job security has done to their family life. They can see that their parents have a job, but they may not have a life. That is not the future many kids want. And to be a successful parent with a successful relationship with your child, a parent must look into a crystal ball, but not his or her own crystal ball. Parents today must share the child's vision of the future, rather than force the child to see the parent's vision of the future, a vision that is often based on the past. Once a parent sees what the child sees and where the child wants to go, there may be a chance for communication and hopefully some guidance. This is crucial, because the moment a parent says to a child, "I don't want you to do that," the child is going to do it, or has already done it. Sharing a vision and minimizing the clashes of winning formulas is vital for long-term guidance. And once good communication is in place, I would recommend that parents begin sharing with the children the fact that they will most likely have many professions in their lifetime. And if a child can grasp that idea, they may then have an increased respect for their education. If a child can gain an increased respect for education and lifelong learning, it may become a little easier to communicate why the idea of developing a personal winning learning formula and staying in school are so important. Developing winning financial formulas. You will remember my rich dad said, "You don't get rich at work, you get rich at home." That is why you must do your homework. Rich Dad did his homework, teaching me the formula for great wealth by playing the game of Monopoly. Taking the time to play the game with his son and me, he was doing his best to take our minds into a world that very few people see. Somewhere between the ages of 9 and 15, I mentally crossed over from the world of my poor dad into the world of my rich dad. It was the same world that everyone could see. It was just that the perception was different. I could see things I had never seen before. In Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland, Alice goes through the looking glass into a different world. Rich Dad took me through his looking glass via the game of Monopoly and let me see the world through his eyes, from his perspective. The mental change came when I sat in on a meeting Rich Dad had with his banker and his real estate agent. They discussed a few details, signed some documents. Rich Dad handed the banker a check, and then he took possession of some keys from the real estate agent. It dawned on me that he had just bought another greenhouse. Getting in his car, the banker, the real estate agent, Rich Dad, Mike, and me drove over to the property to inspect his new greenhouse. As we drove, I was beginning to realize that I was actually seeing in real life what I was doing on the game board of Monopoly. Getting out of the car, I watched Rich Dad walk up the steps, put the key in the door, turn the key, push the door open, step inside, and say, "It's mine." As I said, I learn best by seeing, touching, feeling, and doing. When I understood the tangible relationship between the game, the little green house, and the house he had just bought, my mind changed, and my world changed, because my perception of myself was changing. I was no longer hoping to be rich. In my soul, I was beginning to know with certainty I was rich. I was rich because I was beginning to see the world through my rich dad's eyes. I had found my winning formula. It was a formula that would require a winning learning, professional, and financial formula. It was the formula I would follow for the rest of my life. But entering this world also caused some problems with the world I was leaving behind. The world I returned to on school days seemed like the world of the Mad Hatter, the Marching Cards, and the Cheshire Cat. On Mondays, the teacher would ask us to hand in our homework. She would then hand out more assignments and ask us to study things I really could not see, touch, or feel. I never understood why we studied subjects that we knew we would never use, or at least were never told how to use. I am not suggesting that you take your child out of school and buy a game of Monopoly. A sound education is very important. School teaches basic scholastic and learning skills, and then it teaches professional skills. Although I do not agree entirely with how the system teaches or what it teaches, going to school and getting through college or trade school is still basic to most success in life today. The problem is, school does not teach basic financial skills, and because it does not teach those skills, many kids leave school without a winning financial formula. In fact, many leave with a losing financial formula. Many young people today leave school with credit card debt and debt from school loans. Many never get out of debt. Many leave school and begin buying cars, homes, boats, etc. Many will die and pass that debt on to their kids. In other words, they may leave school well-educated, but they also leave school without one very important formula, the winning financial formula for their lives. Rich Dad explained to me very early on that most people go to work, collect their paychecks, go back to work, collect another paycheck, forever, and never learn that money should be working for them rather than the other way around. Some never learn the lesson. Some, like me, only learn it if they want to and are ready to learn it. The other side of the table. Another lesson that greatly influenced me was the lesson I often call the other side of the table. At around the age of 10, Rich Dad began inviting me to sit with him while he interviewed people for job positions he was filling. I would sit next to him on the other side of the table as he asked job applicants questions about their resumes or their attitude towards working for his companies. It was always an interesting process. I saw people with no high school education willing to work for less than $1 an hour. Although only a kid, I knew that it would be hard to support a family on less than $8 a day before taxes. When I looked at their resumes or applications and saw how many kids some of these workers had to support, my heart grew heavy. I realized that my family was not the only family having a tough time financially. I wanted to help them as I wanted to help my family, but I still didn't know how. The value of a good education. Seeing the difference in pay scale between a worker without a high school degree and a worker with a college degree was incentive enough for me to stay in school. After that, any time I thought about quitting school, the memories of the differences in basic pay came back to remind me why a good education was important. After going through this process of sitting on the other side of the desk about 5 times, I finally asked Rich Dad why he had me sit there. His reply was, "You're learning a very important lesson if you want to be rich. Most people only see the world from the other side of the table." Rich Dad said, pointing to the empty seat in front of us, "Very few people see it from this side of the table. You're seeing the real world, the world people see once they leave school. But you have an opportunity to see it from this side of the table before you leave school. So if I want to be rich, I need to sit on this side of the table," I said. Rich Dad shook his head. "More than just sitting on this side of the table, you have to study and learn what it takes to sit on this side of the table. And most of the time, those subjects are not taught in school. School teaches you to sit on that side of the table." "How does it do that?" I asked, a little bewildered. "Well, for what reason does your dad say to go to school?" Rich Dad asked. "So I can go look for a job," I replied quietly. "And that is what these people are looking for, isn't it?" Rich Dad nodded his head and said, "And that is why they sit on that side of the table. I'm not saying one side is better than the other. All I want to offer you is a choice of which side of the table you eventually sit on. If you want to be rich at a young age, this side of the table gives you a better chance of attaining that goal. If you are serious about being rich and not having to work hard all your life, I will teach you how to do that. If you want to sit on the other side of the table, then follow your dad's advice." That was an important life-directing lesson. Rich Dad did not tell me which side to sit on. He offered me a choice. I made my own decisions. I chose what I wanted to study, rather than fight against what I was being required to study. And that is how my Rich Dad taught me over the years. It was actions first, mistakes second, lessons third. After the lesson, he would give me a choice of what I was to do with the lesson I had learned. The other side of the table lesson included other life-changing lessons. By sitting at the table, I began to make more distinctions or learn new lessons, watching and learning from what was happening in front of me. Once Rich Dad pointed out to me that there were 2 sides of the table, I could see the different worlds that each side came from. I could sense the difference in self-perceptions each side required. Over the years, I realized that the people sitting across the table from me were only doing what they were told to do, which is go out and look for a job. They are taught in school to get the skills employers are looking for. They are not taught to get the skills so they can sit on the other side of the table. Because of those early instructions, most people spend their lives sitting on the other side of the table. How would their lives have been different if they had been told, "Get the financial skills so you can own the table"? People find what they are programmed to look for. I also learned that people look for different things. Rich Dad said to me, "Most people leave school looking for a job, and that is why they find a job." He explained to me that what you look for in your mind is what you find in the real world. He said, "People who go looking for work often find work. I don't look for a job. I've trained my mind to look for business opportunities and investments. I learned long ago that you only find what you train your mind to look for. If you want to be rich, you need to educate your brain to look for things that make you rich." Finally, I had found something that challenged me, gave me a reason to study, something I was interested in studying. Between the ages of 9 and 15, my real education began. I became a lifelong student who knew that my education would continue on long after I left school. The learning pyramid. When I speak about education and learning, I often use a diagram I call the learning pyramid. At the top is the word mental, and below that on one side is spiritual, and on the other side is the word emotional. Below those two words is the word physical. I personally learned so much playing the game of Monopoly. Playing the game caused me to think mentally. My emotional state was excitement, and I physically had to do something. The game held my attention because it involved a lot of me, especially since I am a competitive person. What I mean by spiritual is the feeling we get when we go to something like the Special Olympics, and we see physically challenged kids running or pushing their wheelchairs with all their body, mind, and soul. Their spirits reach out and touch all of our spirits. That is the kind of spiritual learning I'm talking about. When I was in Vietnam, I saw young men fight on even when they knew they were dying. It was their spirit that carried them, giving their lives so their team could live. I simply speak of a power that is beyond our mental, emotional, and physical limits. Between the ages of 9 and 12, I remember going through a fundamental change with my personal learning pyramid. I know I changed my perception of myself mentally, emotionally, physically, and spiritually. After years of feeling bad about myself because I was not smart, at least not as smart as my dad and Andy the Ant, I changed. I felt good about myself. I knew I could make it in life, and I knew I could survive. I knew I would be successful in my own way. I knew that I did not need a high-paying job or even money to do well financially. I had finally seen something that I wanted to be good at, and I knew I could do it well. I had found what I wanted to study. As I said, something changed spiritually, and I felt confident, excited, and good about myself. A warm feeling filled my heart, and then the rest of me. I was certain about who I was and who I was going to become. I had found my new identity. Students leave school unprepared. Schools do not teach the survival skills needed for today's world. Most students leave school financially needy and looking for security. Security that cannot be found outside. Security is found on the inside. Many students leave school unprepared mentally, emotionally, physically, and spiritually. When I say to people, don't depend upon job security, don't depend upon the company to take care of you financially, don't expect the government to take care of your needs when you retire, people often flinch or squirm. Instead of fire and excitement, I see more fear. People cling more to job security rather than trust in their personal abilities. Part of this need for security happens because people never found their new identity and do not trust in their ability to survive on their own. They follow in their parents' footsteps, doing what their parents did and following their parents' advice of go to school so you can get the job skills employers are looking for. Most will find a job, but only a few will find the security they truly look for. It is hard to find true security when your survival is dependent upon someone else who happens to be sitting on the other side of the table. In July of the year 2000, Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank, spoke about inflation. He said that the reason inflation was not as high as it could be, given this period of extremely low unemployment, was because people wanted job security rather than a raise. He went on to explain that most people, fearing the march of technology and the possibility of computers taking their jobs, as has happened in many industries, would rather lay low and work for less. That is why he said the rich were getting richer, but most people were not sharing in the new wealth. He said it was because they were afraid of losing their jobs. I think it was because many people did not learn that they could survive financially on their own, so they took their parents' advice and followed in their footsteps. The end results. The value of a person's education is not found in his or her report card. Most of us know that there are many people who were A students in school and F students at the end of their lives. There are many ways to evaluate how good a person's education was, and one of the best measurements is how they fared financially after leaving school. Your children need your help if they are going to be able to develop the financial skills they need for the future. Children's self-perceptions or ideas of themselves academically and financially will often dictate how they operate for the rest of their lives. That is why a parent's most important job is to monitor, guide, and protect a child's self-perception. Receiving a failing grade at age 15 in English turned out to be a very valuable experience for me because I came to realize that I had developed a bad attitude towards school and my studies. That failing grade was a wake-up call for me to make corrections in my attitude and in my study habits. I also realized early in life that while grades are important in school, financial statements would be my report card once I left school. Rich Dad said to me, "In school, students are given report cards once a quarter. If a child is in trouble, the child at least has time to make the proper corrections, if he or she chooses to. In real life, Most adults never receive a quarterly financial report card, which is why so many people struggle financially. Many adults do not really look at their financial situation until they lose their jobs, have accidents, until they think about retirement, or until it's too late. Because most adults do not have a quarterly financial report card, many adults fail to make the financial corrections necessary to lead a financially secure life. They may have high-paying jobs, big homes, nice cars, and be doing well at work, yet have failing financial grades. Many smart students who had good grades in school could spend their lives scoring failing financial grades. That is the price of not having a financial report card at least once a quarter. I want to look at my financial statement so I know where I am doing well, where I am doing poorly, and what I need to improve upon. That failing grade turned out to be a good thing in the long run, because both Mike and I buckled down a little more in school, although we were never great students. I received congressional nominations from my state senator to the U.S. Naval Academy at Annapolis, Maryland, and the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy at Kings Point, New York. Mike decided to stay in Hawaii to continue his apprenticeship with his dad, so he attended the University of Hawaii, where he graduated in 1969, the same year I graduated from Kings Point. In the long run, that failing grade proved to be priceless, for it caused both Mike and me to change our attitude toward school. At the academy, I overcame my fear of writing and actually learned to enjoy writing, although I am still a technically poor writer. If not for Dr. A.A. Norton, my English teacher for 2 years at the academy, and Sharon Lecter, my co-author, I doubt if I would have become a New York Times and Wall Street Journal best-selling author today. In the end, I realized that report cards measure not so much what we know, but what we need to improve upon in our lives. The same is true with your personal financial statement. It is your report card on how well you are doing financially. It is your report card for life. Your financial statement is your real-life report card. As my rich dad often said, my banker has never asked me for my report card. He also said, one of the reasons people struggle financially is because they leave school not knowing what a financial statement is. Your child needs a financial report card now. I received a financial head start at the age of 9. That was the year Rich Dad introduced me to my financial report card. Another of my Rich Dad's lessons teaches the importance of financial literacy, or the ability to read financial statements. Rich Dad was preparing his son and me by teaching us the basics of financial literacy. Understanding a basic financial statement gave me tremendous financial confidence and maturity around money. I understood the difference between assets and liabilities, income and expenses, and the importance of cash flow. Many adults do not know the subtle differences, and that lack of education causes them to work hard and make lots of money, yet not get ahead financially. But there is something more than confidence I gained by understanding how a financial statement works. Rich Dad often referred to the 3 C's, which stand for confidence, control, and correction. He would say, if you understand how financial statements really work, you will have more confidence over your finances, you will have more control over your finances, and most importantly, you will be able to make corrections when things are not going your way financially. People who lack financial literacy simply have less financial confidence, and so they lose control and rarely make corrections until it is too late in life. At an early age, I began learning mentally, emotionally, physically, and then spiritually, the ins and outs of the 3 C's. I did not fully understand it then, and I still do not fully understand it today. Yet that basic financial education was the foundation for constant, lifelong financial learning. This basic financial education gave me a financial head start in life, and it all began with understanding the financial statement. To begin, Rich Dad gave some definitions. He said, an asset puts money in your pocket, while a liability takes money from your pocket. To clarify, he got out his yellow legal pad and drew 2 boxes, one for income and one for expenses. Below, he would draw 2 more boxes for assets and liabilities. For each asset and each liability, he would include an arrow showing where the cash went, into his pocket or out. Rich Dad said to me, the confusion with this simple approach occurs because the accepted method of accounting allows us to list both assets and liabilities under the asset column. He explained his thinking with an example. If we have a $100,000 house that someone has put $20,000 cash down on and now has an $80,000 mortgage, how do you know if this house is an asset or a liability? Is the house an asset just because it is listed under the asset column? The answer is, of course, no. The real answer is, you need to refer to the income statement to find out if it is an asset or a liability. If there is no income and your expenses include a mortgage, real estate taxes, insurance, utilities, and maintenance, then it is a liability. I realized where he was going. If this example included rental income and net rental income, the key word being net, then that change to the financial statement changes this house from a liability to an asset. More specific to our example, let's say that all the expenses associated with this house added up to $1,000, and you now have a tenant paying you $1,200 a month. Now you have a net rental income of $200 per month. This house is now putting money in your pocket, as verified by the $200 income. It is now a true asset. Rich Dad said, "It is the relationship of these terms that are most important. What determines if something is really an asset and not just a piece of junk you list on your balance sheet is cash flow. Cash flow could be the most important word in the world of money, and yet often the least understood. You can see cash, but most people do not see the flow. Hence, it is cash flow that determines if something is really an asset or a liability or a piece of junk. It is the cash flowing between the income statement and the balance sheet that truly defines what is an asset or liability," Rich Dad said over and over. If you want to give your child a financial head start in life, memorize this line and repeat it over and over to your child. Your child must understand this statement and repeat it often if it is to sink in. The asset is cash flowing money into the income column. The liability is cash flowing money out of the expense column. You do not need to be a rocket scientist to know that there is a difference between money going in or money going out. To reinforce this basic idea, Rich Dad would often say, "Assets put money in your pocket, and liabilities take money from your pocket." As a 9-year-old kid, I understood this. Many adults do not. As I got older and understood that many adults were clinging to job security, Rich Dad would upgrade his definition. He would say, "If you lose your job, assets will feed you and liabilities will eat you." He would also say, "Most of my employees cannot stop working because they are buying liabilities that they think are assets, cars, boats, and sometimes houses, and they are being eaten alive every month paying bills to feed those liabilities that they think are assets." Again, it was a little more sophisticated definition, but sitting across the table as people applied for jobs or cried when they were fired, I understood why knowing the difference between assets and liabilities was so important. That was a huge financial head start in life for me.